Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Robin Barnes is a four-term member of the PSIA National Alpine Team and the Director of Skier Services at Heavenly Mountain Resort and the former director of the Ski and Snowboard School in Portillo, Chile. Robin also serves as a contributing author and reviewer of 32 Degrees magazine, the official publication of the Professional Ski Instructors of America. Barnes is a self-confessed skiing addict and rejoices in every kind of snow imaginable. I love ripping it up in a GS course, she says with her characteristic enthusiasm, frolicking in the bumps or tracking up fresh snow. I sought Robin out because her unique background has allowed her to see the world of ski instruction from every angle. She is the quintessential real skier who, during her Portillo tenure, would log 275 days a year on snow. I caught up to Robin at her office at Heavenly Valley, gearing up for the 24-25 ski season, which is just getting underway. Greetings, Robin, and welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan.
Jackson Hogan, good morning to you. Great morning to you, and thank you very much for having me this morning.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you with us. We'll get to your current job responsibilities in due course, but I want to focus first on some big picture issues that are currently facing the world ski resorts. I'm sure you're aware that skier participation numbers are way up after a long plateau here in the U.S. First question, are you seeing a surge in novice skier participation? And have you had to alter your menu, so to speak, to serve this clientele?
I'll answer that in a couple of different ways. I love talking about this, frankly, because as you said, skier visits in the United States were flatlining or slightly declining for a really long time, almost as long as I can remember. And as an industry, we've been working on, like, what are we going to do when, like, specifically baby boomers leave the sports of skiing and riding? Like, how are we going to replace them? It's been an issue that has been on the table, again, it's almost as long as I can remember. And who knew a global pandemic happens? And all of a sudden, ski resorts are probably seeing people come at a faster rate than we would have anticipated. And so we're playing a little bit of catch up with this increase in volume, I think. Have we had more novices? I would say yes. Where I spend most of my time these days at Heavenly Mountain Resort, because of the proximity to the Bay Area, we tend to have a fairly robust volume of beginners that are learning how to ski and learning how to snowboard. It is probably incrementally increased.
What do you do to help retain these new skiers? I remind you, since you're familiar with the statistics going back many years, we used to scare away skiers by the hundreds of thousands. At a time, one time I remember when I was active on the equipment side, I think there was something like an 85% failure of ski trial. In other words, went skiing, hated it, thanks, don't want to do that again. What do we do to keep that new skier now so he doesn't become a dropout? What becomes of new skiers? What is their first day like?
Such an important question. And like in the industry, as you know, it's called retention and conversion. Like, how do we retain skiers that we have and how do we convert new people to the sports to become skiers and riders? I think for a long time, we told people to come and try skiing and come and try snowboarding. I feel like little by little, the messaging is starting to get tweaked a little bit to come and become a skier and come and become a snowboarder, which is a completely different story. And if we kind of make this assumption that people might want to come and become mountain people and skiers and snowboarders, they will show up and how we will show up with them, I think, is different. When they come specifically for a lesson experience, I mean, number one is we have to show them a really kick-ass experience. Am I allowed to swear on
this? Absolutely. This is a liberal family program.
So I think that's number one. And right now, again, post-pandemic, everything's automated. You sign up for things on your phone. You buy a lift ticket online. You make reservations online for your rental equipment. So it's been automated, and certainly some people of certain generations have a harder time with that automation because it's less people oriented. And the truth is, the new generation of people that we really need to come into the sport are used to that. And that's part of making it a more automated, expeditious, less standing in lines process. I think that's ultimately a win for us, especially the resorts that supplement any online automated process where you can actually go talk to a human being. I think that's where we can really hit the nail on the head. ski instruction is changing a little bit to where actually a lot of it, where there maybe used to be 20 or 25 people in a lesson and you stood in a line and you slid down the hill when your instructor told you and how your instructor told you. And I think now we're just kind of like, well, our clothing is looser, right? Thanks to snowboarding. And I think our lessons are a little bit looser now too, where it's not, again, stand in line and go on command, but it's, hey guys, let's try this and everybody scatter and give this a go for a few minutes and try it 3 or 4 times, right? 10 times if you like moving faster, come back, report. How did that feel? How was that? That's what we should be expecting out of lessons today, that it's more discovery and more play and less tight clothing and less tight environments.
If I'm a newbie, do I get on snow on the first day? And I assume I'd get my rental skis all outfitted for me. But I'm not in a classroom type environment. I'm very much in an on snow environment right from the first day.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. There may be, I know a couple of decades ago, there were some schools that you met inside and you went over some basic stuff. The rental shop for sure will help take care of getting your boots set up as well as they can. But your lesson, I can't really think of an exception to it. Your lesson should take place outdoors on the snow. Almost every place that I can think of, you meet your cohorts that will take place in the learning environment with you and your instructor. You meet outside, you start to get introduced to, here's the learning environment that you'll start to slide around in. Here's the lifts that we'll use. Here's the terrain that we'll use. Yeah, that should all be taking place outside.
So what are realistic goals for skills progression for the new skier, the new client?
Getting comfortable getting in and out of your gear, whether it's skis or snowboards, getting comfortable walking around, whether you're going from the slope and you're headed into lunch, you want to feel comfortable walking around and navigating around people, sliding down a hill and grooving with gravity a little bit, comfortable controlling your speed, comfortable stopping, comfortable turning so that you can avoid objects and people, change direction, and then culminating in skiing a nice green run, feeling like you're kind of dancing. You feel the rhythm of a left turn and a right turn and a left turn and a right turn and a little wind in your face. Yeah, I just really feel like you're out there in nature, feeling a little wind in your face, and feels good to be sliding, and you can do that.
So let's assume that the skier gets the bug on the first day. How many more days of lessons do you think is advisable to sort of allocate, if you're thinking of your total winter time? How many days should I be planning to spend to get good enough to be able to comfortably solo at least on part of the mountain?
Certainly it depends on the person, how much of their life have they spent A, playing sports, B, being coached in sports? Are they self-learners? Are they risk takers? Or do they like to be more conservative? I like to say, keep taking lessons until you're comfortable on a blue run. At most resorts in the world, the majority of runs are blue runs, at least 2/3. And then, so if you can get comfortable on blue runs, then you can ski the majority of most mountains. Once you're comfortable on blue runs, then I think it becomes more personalized. Do you feel safe with an instructor and you like to be guided in the process so that you can learn about the terrain, about snow conditions, about times of day to ski here or times of day to ski there? And then there's other people that just be a little bit more independent with it. But I'm a big believer in definitely take lessons each day until you feel competent on green runs, and then sort of intersperse discovering on your own, check back in on a lesson, go discover something on your own, check back in with a lesson until, again, you can ski most of the mountain. And then the frequency that you may want to have lessons may be less. Of course, you learn a lot as you're a novice skier. And then each advancement, as you get better and better and better, you have to work a little bit harder and a little bit longer for. But I'm a big believer in, if people that are elite skiing and snowboarding athletes train with a coach on a regular basis, that all of us can use coaching on a regular basis. And maybe it's just once or twice a season if you're very advanced. Maybe it's once a month, but the things you learn being with a coach, again, what the snow conditions are like, how to adjust, because there's not one turn that fits all, right? If you're skiing powder, you'll use a different skill set than you'll use when the snow is hard. There's tactics to use on a busy Saturday afternoon that you might be able to use different tactics. If it's 9 a.m. on a Wednesday afternoon, how you can use the terrain, how you can, you know, really make the most of your experience out on the hill. And those are the things that you gain partly through experience and partly through someone that has the upper hand on experience that can work with you on those things so that, again, you can really maximize your time out there.
I would contend that Americans are largely under-instructed. And we'll get back to that. My favorite line is, you do realize that Tiger Woods has a coach. He's pretty good already. But he thinks he could use a coach. You might want to consider that, that little fact in your own life. I want to turn the subject around a little bit and pull back the curtain on what it's like entering the business side of skiing through the instruction portal. What percentage of your instructors, whether it's Heavenly Valley or Portillo, are newbies? And do you see any changes in who is serving as new instructors during your long tenure, either Portillo or Heavenly Valley?
I'll speak to where I was before director first in Portillo. It's a very small elite school there. And by elite, I mean really, really high-end, experienced, qualified instructors of about 40. And the turnover there is very, very low. So probably maybe 10%, 15% of instructors are new there each year. But again, Portillo is a very specialized environment. A lot of the guests from Portillo utilize the ski and snowboard school, a much higher percentage than most ski resorts in other places in the world. At Heavenly, it's been different how we had a worldwide pandemic, and then, of course, businesses all over the world and every aspect of business had a hard time staffing. And then we pretty much recovered from the pandemic, and then staffing became less of an issue. So I think right now we're probably on track at about 25, maybe 30% of the instructing staff are new. Some of them have come back to the industry, come back to snow sports education. And who are they? They're all walks of life. They're people just out of university. They're people who are retiring. There are people that coach other sports at a very high level and want to learn about snow sports instruction. We just went through our first bout of new team members, so new instructor training here at Heavenly Mountain Resort. And I'll tell you what, the quality of people that came through that program is very inspiring. And I have every reason to feel really optimistic about how those folks will perform and ultimately develop. And hopefully I'm 10 years from now and they're still on staff and they've developed into really seasoned instructors. Yeah, I feel very optimistic about where we are with the instructing staff. And I think that's probably not so dissimilar from other major resorts, and at least in the United States.
That's encouraging to hear, because from my point of view, it would seem that retaining new instructors is a challenge simply because resort living is really expensive and newbie instructor income is not fabulous. There's a hierarchy at the PSIA that one can move up. And as one moves up, one is more amply compensated. But don't you, generally speaking, either have to be retired or have another job to be an entry-level instructor?
Yes and no. So it's a similar thing with our guests. Some of our guests come to learn how to ski and snowboard because they want the experience. They're not trying to become skiers or snowboarders. Also, some people come to be instructors that are doing it for a season or two because they think it will be fun, and they don't enter the profession thinking they're going to become lifelong ski instructors or snowboard instructors. Certainly, again, we hope that they have a kick-ass experience and they decide to stay in it for year after year. And absolutely, it's expensive to live in resort towns today. And again, that's all over the world. It's not just ski resorts, it's just resort towns typically are expensive. Housing is expensive. I think for the whole snow sports industry and maybe just for the recreation industry, employee housing is a big action item. I know we just got a contract with some new employee housing that's absolutely beautiful. Like, I would live in it. It's new. So employee housing is a big push. And I think, yes, if you're an entry-level instructor, you may have to be willing to share a place with a couple of roommates, maybe have a second job. I know certainly all of them do not, but most don't rent a studio apartment with a view of the lake. So I think housing is the biggest thing the entry-level wage is, again, in instruction, it's probably better than it is in a lot of industries, and resort towns are expensive, so that offsets that a little bit. Tipping is more prevalent than it used to be, for sure. That never hurts.
I just want to put in a vote for tipping. Your boot fitter would like a little tip now and then as well. Thinking big picture, moving up to, say, the 10,000 foot and looking down, could we make ski instruction more attractive to potential recruits if the system were different? For example, there's a European model in which instructors aren't exclusively owned by the resort. You can have the Robin Barnes Ski School, and I could have the Jackson Hole Ski School, and we could both have our shingle hung out, let's say, at Kitzbühel. That's not the U.S. model, and I wonder if the U.S. model, in fact, maybe hurts the entry-level instructor. I'm not sure which ends up being better for instructors, but you probably being better traveled might be able to speak to what's different, both to the skier and to the instructor, with the European model versus the U.S. model.
Yeah, that's such a good question. And I feel like one of the things that you could argue either side with some validity, certainly the European model where it's a concession ski school, and you and me and every single person on this call potentially could own a concession stand or a concession school, let's say at a place like Zermatt. So from a guest perspective, there's probably not as much consistency from one school to the other, like with pricing, with timing, with quality of instruction, and there's probably more competition, so maybe pricing is lower, right? From an instructor standpoint, again, from it's always greener on the other side, there's certainly some attraction to owning a small ski school. And then all of your marketing dollars come out of your pocket, all the insurance. You have to take care of whether it's 10 instructors or 100 instructors that you have. If there's not business, then you don't get work. Is there health insurance? Is there some sort of employee housing? I'll give a boost to Vail Resorts right now. There's a lot of employee assistance programs. There's really good health insurance. There's a lot of things that working for a bigger company do for you. One of those things is not freedom. Like, there's obviously some level of constraint that comes from working with a bigger company and what a bigger company can offer compared to a small concession school. There's no comparison. So it's a matter of, do you want a tofu burger or you want a steak, right? It's a matter of what do you like, what level of risk and independence are you willing to have if you're working in one of those concession schools, and what level of sort of security with some constraints do you get for working for a bigger school?
For those of my dear listeners who aren't familiar with the PSIA meritocracy, could you give a thumbnail description of the skills required to pass levels 1, 2, and 3?
You bet. I think a lot of people outside of the industry aren't aware that there's different levels of instructor certification in all countries. So a level 1 certification is our most entry level, where you're coached and then later on assessed on your abilities to coach our guests to be novice skier. So that goes from it's my first time stepping into my gear all the way through I can link basic turns with a little bit of parallel in there on a green run. And then the next step up on there is that you are coached on and assessed to being able to coach students up through intermediate skiing. So like a semi-dynamic parallel turn if you're a skier. And I apologize, I'm a little bit embarrassed to say this, but I don't know what the equivalent of that is on snowboarding from a skills perspective, but being comfortable riding down and linking turns on blue terrain and some basic park maneuvers. And then the highest level of certification is level 3, where you are coached and assessed to being able to coach people on any terrain, under any conditions, on any equipment. And part of that coaching and assessment process is on your technical knowledge, like, do you put your weight here? How do you pivot the board? Things like that. And also on understanding the difference between learning and teaching and understanding how to convey thoughts, pace information, allow time for reflecting on the learning process, adapting your shtick, if you will, to different people and places. And then lastly, on your people skills, basically your ability to create a trusting environment and your emotional intelligence skills.
Would I be correct in saying that if we were to compare the PSIA ladder to an actual ladder, that the rung from not being an instructor to level one is of a certain distance. The space to level two might be, that rung might be a little farther away. And then to get up to level three, you've got to have game.
You've got to have game. From a skiing and snowboarding standpoint, a pretty high level of athleticism and skill level and versatility, absolutely. And then again, your communication skills, your understanding of how to connect with people and how to, again, not just be able to regurgitate information from page 36 of a technical manual, but really be able to connect to a guest so that that guest is learning something and you're more concerned with what the guest is learning than what page 36 on the manual says.
What part of this system, this meritocracy that we currently have, what part of it's working well for both the student and the instructor? And is there anywhere along the line where there's a feeling that it needs a little bit of help, a little repair?
That's a nice question. The organization that educates and certifies instructors, it's the Professional Ski Instructors of America and the American Association of Snowboard Instructors. It's been evolving for a really long time. We represent the United States and skiing nations around the world, and we're pretty well known for doing a good job. The difficult part of it is, for example, if our instructors are part-time, like how do you find the time if they're part-time? And of course, part-timers generally don't come in when business is slow. How do you find the time to continue to evolve that person's understanding of what it's like to teach snow sports? That's one of our biggest things. And then, of course, like everything, it's a bit of a trickle down. So people like the national team that I'm a part of, we help to create content. And then it's the telephone game as it goes down. So there's a lot of people. There's about 35,000 members in the organization. And it's hard to make all the information and get it disseminated as well as in an ideal world, I guess. So that's definitely a challenge, just the volume. And a country like Switzerland has a similar process and a similar program. Switzerland geographically is less of a challenge than it is in the United States, simply by the size of the country. It's a challenge to get information disseminated to such a big geographical area and such a wide range of people.
One arena in which you are especially qualified to comment is the role of women within PSA in particular, and the ski market in general. I think it was some internal research that I was shared a couple of years ago from about women who were active in PSIA, and it read sort of like a list of grievances about the perceived imbalance between men and women in its ranks. Do you feel that women are adequately represented among either the rank and file or the leadership of PSIA?
Oh, no way. It's just here in the Western region of PSIA Aussie. It's something like 30% of leadership are women and 30% are level three certified instructors. And it goes up slightly when you're talking about non-certified or level one certified instructors. But as the level of time commitment increases and the level of skill level, women unfortunately drop out of the industry or don't continue to strive in the industry. The study that you're talking about was done with a pretty big survey group. And some of the issues that women stated as being kind of hurdles to their progressing in the industry was not having female role models, not having childcare, not having lactation rooms. Like if you're a mom, like that used to be a game changer. Like where would you go if you didn't have a place to bring your child or a place to nurse during the middle of the day? Like where would you go? And I think in our industry, also, little by little, we're starting to recognize that those are real issues that we need to address so that we can keep females in the industry. I will tell you, Jackson, I grew up with three older brothers, and I never thought I wasn't as tough as them. I never thought I wasn't as fast as them. so it hasn't been anything that I personally have felt as a hurdle, and I would be completely ignorant and blind if I didn't recognize that it's a real issue in our world today. And certainly in the snow sports industry today. And I certainly am on board and doing everything that I can to participate. Carol Levine, who is an alumni in the National Alpine Team and is just an incredibly brilliant mind in our industry, shared a quote with me the other day that really resonated with me, is that equity is the process with equality being the goal. If in the short term, in the process, we need to do things to create equity, and maybe that is making certain that we have more females in leadership roles so that there are more role models with the long-term or hopefully not so long-term outcome being quality for both men and women. That quote really resonated with me.
What was your career path like from newbie to head honcho?
My career path was completely spontaneous, honestly. I was a wide-eyed young adult driving across the country looking for an adventure. Didn't entirely know where I was stopping. I had roughly a plan to stop in San Francisco. Stopped in Lake Tahoe for what was to be a week that turned into the rest of the season. I had a ton of support. And actually, I looked back on this winter, my first season teaching skiing, there were a lot of level three women around. And so maybe I didn't realize it at the time, but those women probably mentored me maybe even more than I realized it at the time, or at least I didn't feel like I was alone in the world because I was striving to be a really great instructor as a female. Started here selling tickets and then got offered a job teaching skiing the next season. And I thought, oh, I'll veer from whatever plans I had as a 21-year-old and come back and teach skiing just for one season. And that is when I met all those level three women. But the whole team here just supported me a lot and gave me a lot of confidence that I could do well in this industry. That same winter, I got my first level of certification, which at the time was an associate's or a level two. And then that next winter, I met who was the ski and ride school director in Portillo at the time. Jimmy Ackerson is his name. I was just loving teaching skiing in this environment and learning, and instruction is just about giving, right? And giving certainly feels better than receiving. And I thought, wow, I can do this year round and learn languages. This is amazing. So I hopped on that opportunity, got my level three a couple of years after that, got involved as a educational staff member for a while, and then ultimately set my sights on becoming a national team member. Failed forward at that a couple of times before I was eventually successful. I'm grateful and fortunate there's been a lot of people that have helped kick me in the butt and tell me that they believed in me along the way that have definitely propelled my love for this career.
Let's shift our perspective back to that of your prospective customers. What if you're an experienced skier, for example, and you want to fill some gaps in your resume? You're aware, for example, that you're, like most Americans, terrible in moguls. So you'd rather stop avoiding them and learn how to ski them. Almost everyone wants to learn to ski powder, but kind of tricky from a lesson standpoint, since its availability is notoriously unpredictable and a small window no matter when it comes. So how do you learn to teach powder without powder? And then you have the reality that most Americans, in fact, no matter where else you might teach them, are on groomed runs. And they're pretty terrible at that, too. There's a lot of opportunity for instruction. Do you see people coming back and sort of looking at instruction as a menu and saying, I'd like to order an appetizer of moguls and a main course of powder or something like that?
Yes, absolutely. I hope it's okay that I share this quote from Michael Rogan, my husband, Michael Rogan, that it's not that you can't ski moguls, it's that you can't ski and the moguls prove it. And what he means by that is having a skill set is what allows you to ski moguls, and having a skill set to be able to have a lower edge angle and really turn your skis in a round but short and relatively flat turn shape will lend itself to more success in the moguls, for example, and being able to manage your skis so you don't go thud, thud, thud every time you hit a bump, but rather you massage the moguls and in a technical term, we would say managing pressure, but just manage how hard the moguls hit the snow and hit the moguls. And then when you come up over the mogul, does it launch you in the air, or can you manage that so that, again, your skis just sort of massage their way over the bumps? And I think people do generally come to lessons saying they want to ski powder or they want to ski moguls or they want to learn to carve. And that's wonderful. And people should continue to have goals like that. You can apply those skills in different places. If you're skiing on hard snow, you're going to be concerned with using your edges more. If you're in soft snow, you might be concerned with not using your edges as much and being very light and kind of delicate on the snow. So yes, I think people come in there for the menu offerings, certainly from a marketing standpoint, saying we're going to make you a better mogul skier. We will make you a better park rider. That's attractive, and it all comes down in the end to having skills and understand the tactical differences about doing those, just like driving your car. When you're in the middle of the night or wee hours of the morning and you're on a freeway, you're going fast, you're taking maybe the corners a little bit faster, just how you navigate the road is going to be different than 5 o'clock in downtown San Francisco with a lot of traffic. You change the tactics about how you drive. And I think that's really important to consider different environments, whether, again, you're in a park, you're in Powder, you're in Vogtle, you're in a crowded Groomer. Being able to change your approach based on that environment is important.
I couldn't agree more. Americans are, by and large, not taking lessons. In other words, the majority of people that come to a ski resort aren't in ski school for a single day. And I think it's partly because the way we've redesigned equipment to dumb it down, it's easy to reach a level of self-taught contentment where edging and control never really enters the equation. From one perspective, you could say, well, so what? The skier is happy, they're skiing, why pay for a lesson? And my simple answer to that, and I invite you to comment upon it immediately thereafter, is it's for your safety, knucklehead, and it's for the safety of you and for others. Because if you can't properly aim your skis and you can't be predictable on your skis, you are trouble, both for yourself and for everyone else on the hill. And if you don't learn fundamentals, you're going to stay that way until you wreck. You're not only putting yourself at risk, you're putting other people, including children and families, at risk quite unnecessarily. You need to still learn skills. You can't just show up.
Yeah, no, I 100% am in alignment with you on that one. Yeah, I think also, like, decades ago, it used to be called the skier's responsibility code. Now it's called your responsibility code, right? It was everywhere. Like, you couldn't go anywhere at a resort without seeing it. And you just don't see it that much anymore. I've been on a personal campaign to make sure it's strewn all over the place here at Heavenly Resort, because I think it's important that people recognize that there are etiquettes and common sense. And frankly, a lot of people are out there and they just, and in both good and a bad way, they get so caught up with the wind in their face and they're having fun. They kind of forget that people are to the left and to the right and below them. And they're just, again, it's a good thing, because it's why you and I both love skiing. And you have to add on to that exhilaration, just an awareness of your surroundings and awareness of your personal safety and keeping those around you safe. I can't agree with that anymore. Skills, and again, it's not just about making a better turn. It's about being able to read the terrain. It's about reading the pitch of the terrain, the snow conditions on the terrain. Is it sunny here? Is it shady here? Is it busy here? Is it not busy here? And being able to adjust your tactics because of how that snow or piece of terrain or hour of the day might have changed. Totally agree with you that skills help keep people safe. They also, like, if you're a golfer, for example, and you go out and you play golf and you miss the ball every single time, you're not going to have much fun. The good and bad thing about skiing is it's completely subjective unless you're in a race course. If you suck but you're having fun, there's no measurement there. And if you're a brilliant skier and you're not having fun, there's no measurement there. But you can have fun and, what is it, high thrill, low skill? That's okay. I'm not judging people because there's a low skill level. I love when there's people out there that are learning. But just like golf or any other sport, the more skillful you become and the more educated you are about your environment, what direction's the wind coming from, when the ball hits the grass, is it thick grass, is it hard grass, is the grass tilted this way, like, that's going to tell you how the ball will behave, right? And similarly in skiing, like, being educated about those things makes it a gazillion times easier and more fun, because you're not having surprises constantly that you're reacting to. You're going, oh, I know what the snow looks like, and so I know what it's going to feel like. And I'm on these skis today, so I know how they're going to react. And you ski it and you crash it versus getting down and go, whew, dodged that one. It's fun to be good at something.
Skiers always want to get tips from instructors. So I'm going to ask you for a few tips. Is there any dry land prep? I hesitate to call it training because training sounds very much like a commitment. But is there any dry land prep that you recommend before skiers go out and hit the slopes?
Yes, commit to your training. I mean, anything really, whether you're working on your strength, your flexibility, your endurance, it's all really important. If it's early season and you ride a bike, or you like to run, or you like to hike or go for walks, like anything that you can do just to work on your body's ability to keep exerting itself a little bit over a long period of time is going to help. If you like strength training 100%, get your bum, your thighs, your core strong. It's going to make you more successful out there. A lot of people do that, and then they don't work on the flexibility side of things. I mean, anything you can do is going to be better. At a minimum, resorts usually open little by little. So if you're fortunate enough to live at a resort, you know, you probably don't want to go out and ski all day, every day, but you go ski for an hour and you start, and then the next day you ski for a couple of hours so that you work yourself up so you're not riddled with lactic acid. To keep yourself safe and to keep yourself from being able to do what you want to with your skis or board, you do have to commit to a certain level of fitness. If you're happy cruising around on easier runs, you probably can get away with doing the minimal stuff, but working on strength training and working on flexibility training and endurance is going to pay off a thousandfold in how you feel out on the hills.
Any advice for the first run of the season?
Be an active observer. Like, don't be a judger about how it is that you're skiing, but early season snow can be interesting because it can be man-made snow or it can be a little bit of snow that changes a lot over the day. Like, go out and just slide around. What do your skis feel like? What do your boots feel like? What's your body feel like? What's the snow feel like? Take inventory of things. I tend to ski with a pretty low edge angle and a slower speed early season so that I can be an observer and take inventory of what's going on. Again, an easy way to get hurt is to ski as fast as you were in the springtime when you'd logged in a bunch of days already. If you've had your equipment tuned or any new equipment, like, it's going to react differently under your feet. Yeah, just take inventory. Feel what's going on and take mental notes of it without judging and without high expectations for performance.
I don't want to wade too deeply into the mechanics of skiing, but can you provide a simple sort of pre-flight checklist that every skier should do before every run? I mean, I have my own, and I could take over my own conversation and say it, but what would you put on a pre-flight checklist before you push off and join the melee of your fellow skiers on the hill? What should your checklist be?
Another great question, and probably something that, maybe this sounds judgmental, and I'm sorry if it does, but probably something that most people don't do before they push off. Again, how are you feeling? Is it the end of the day and you're tired, and so therefore you should make the decision to kind of take it easy? Is the slope uncrowded and you feel like $1 million and just had an espresso and like it's your time to be athletic and let it rip? But I think, again, standing at the top of the run, what does the crowd look like? Is it busy? Is it not busy? Is it busy on the left side but not the right side? What's the snow like? Today, I took my first run on man-made snow at 9 a.m. and I was fairly confident that it was going to be pretty good. And it was my first run of the day, so I went to the left of the run, went to the right of the run, looked at what the grooming was like, looked to see if there's any hard spots. Is the grooming hard? Is it soft? Just super in tune of what surface I was going to be skiing on so that when I came up and did another lap, I could do it proactively. And so I would ski around a little bit, check out the snow, and then rip a couple turns, and then check out the snow, rip a couple turns. Surface changes every single day. Your skis change every day. Sometimes your boots fit differently, depending on if you're dehydrated or not. Maybe your foot's a little fatter or not. What's the crowd like? What's the terrain like? What do your skis and boots feel like? How do you feel? Like, just registering all that stuff deliberately, I think, is really important for a checklist.
I think it's absolutely key that you look at the flow that you're about to enter. I tend to think of skiing as a flow. So does Mike Rogan when we've talked about this sort of thing. It's a continuum, and you're joining into a lot of other people's continuums. And you have to make sure that the space that you're filling is going to be appropriate for the way that you plan to ski. You can't go 90 miles an hour in a crowd, and you can't try to hit a jump that's going to land you in the middle of an area where children are trying their first snowplows. You got to look at the context that you're in. That's what I would say. Be aware of where you are in space.
100%. Just like, again, are you driving on the freeway or you're driving in city traffic at 5 p.m. and how you approach that would be completely different. I think what you just said, you can't be flying down when there's kids around or novice skiers. Just recognizing, like, we're all in here together. It's a big community. And if I'm straight lining down because I know I can handle it, but I'm really bumming out the person that I just maybe I was 12 feet away from that person, but that made that person feel uncomfortable. Like, let's all just be out here and enjoy this together. And how can we support each other and make each other have the best day possible versus, you know, I don't care about my neighbors here because I feel like going straight today. Like, that's not good juju.
Well put. You're a four-term member of the PSIA National Alpine Team, which we outside the instructor culture simply call it the demo team incorrectly, but I think that term is stuck. What are the duties of a demo team member?
I'm a part of the Alpine team because I'm an Alpine skier. There's also a snowboard team, a Nordic team, an adaptive team, a telemark team. And basically we compete once every 4 years to be a part of this team. And then if we're successful, we spend the next 4 years essentially traveling around the U.S. and internationally coaching other instructors, to a lesser degree, ski patrol, ski coaches on some of the things that I mentioned earlier about, you know, the technical aspects of skiing, the teaching skills, how to create a really kick-ass learning environment, the people skills associated with it. So how do we create trust and how are we socially aware and self-aware? But the expectation certainly is that we can ski at a pretty high level so that when we're out on the road, what we're doing, I guess, stands apart a little bit, both from an instruction and a coaching standpoint. We help to create content for what our country believes is important and what we prioritize over that season. We create manuals. We represent the United States internationally when skiing nations get together for a big event once every 4 years called InterSki. We work with manufacturers to help promote their gear and in some cases give input to their gear. We're kind of industry ambassadors to a large degree. Yeah, it's a pretty good gig. It's good work when you can get it.
Let's talk about gear for a bit before we finish. What's your preferred everyday ski? What do you teach on?
I'm a little old school with this, Jackson, but my favorite ski probably is the Head eSpeed GS ski. It's not a World Cup GS ski. It's a wood core sidewall ski with a 17 meter radius. I like the feeling of pressing against the ski and creating pressure and managing that. I'll tell you, last year with our winter, I didn't ski that ski hardly at all. I skied in either 99 waisted skis or 105 waisted skis a lot because it was deep snow. But I would say my daily driver is like what we would call it, our Beer League GS ski.
By the way, dear listeners, while Robin tried to poo-poo the fact that this wasn't a full-on FIS GS race ski, thank God, because it had to be only about 90 to bend one of those, but it's still a burly ski, and it's a lot more ski than your typical customer would be on. What's the best waist width for taking it for the student, for taking a lesson on groomers?
Oh, that's a great question. Has a little bit to do with the level of the skier and where they're skiing, like is it an environment that's comfortable going a little bit faster on or not. I tend to think probably around 75 or 80 right now is probably a good width for most skiers. It's narrow enough that if you tip it up, it can carve, and it's wide enough that it will be friendly to skidding if you're making a shorter turn or if you want to plop off into the trees and plop off and do some moguls. I tend to think that's a pretty versatile ski, whereas a narrow ski sometimes can be a little bit too responsive, can be like the edge of the ski is fairly close under your foot. So if you tip your foot just a little bit, the edge will engage. And not everybody wants that level of reaction, I guess, from their skis.
So that's the advice on skis, something in the 75 to 80 millimeter waist width for taking a lesson on groomers, which I think, I don't know that I would bother to teach somebody who showed up with a 100 underfoot for a groomer lesson. I'd say, I don't know, this is doomed from the start. But let's talk about the other major component of alpine gear. The boot. In my opinion, if the boot isn't at least somewhat properly fit, the whole process is shot.
Yeah, it definitely complicates things. As an instructor, when I would see people that were on boots that were really big and I would maybe escort them back into the shop to get them smaller, for example, the guests would always tell me, well, they gave me a smaller pair to try, but it was too small, so I upsized. I think when you're not used to being in such a constrictive thing, the rigidness of it, the fact that it comes up on your leg, a lot of beginners aren't used to that sensation and always want to go bigger to be more comfortable. And then, of course, it's like a nail in a coffee can or something and shake it up. It's just kind of flopping. Your foot's just flopping around in the boot versus having a nice snug fit where movements that you're attempting to do are transmitted to the ski through that boot and just have a way better experience.
You've been living for quite some time with another of the world's top instructors slash coaches, one Mike Rogan, a 9-time, I think, national alpine team member. Do you and Mike share ideas and experiences, or do you generally try to keep work and home separate?
No, we 100% talk about skiing, coaching. You know, sometimes we talk about it a lot, and other times I can say, hey, I was skiing today and like I had this sensation. What do you think about that? And we can have a 60-second conversation, and that's massively valuable, or he'll say the same thing. What do you think about this? Sometimes they're in depth the last hours, and other times it's just looking for a little feedback, and it's a 60-second conversation that feeds either of us for a really long time.
I can't imagine a much more empathic or effective sounding board. As you know, I think the world of your chosen escort, Mr. Rogan. I think he is.
Yes, he's quite special in a lot of reasons.
He's a special man. So let's conclude on this. Everyone wants an instructional tip. We've already given them a few. How do you get the most? We've convinced you to take a lesson. How do you get the most out of it?
Oh, I wish I could write this in the sky every single day that resorts were open. Be curious, ask questions. The instructor is the expert on what they're doing at that time, but you're the expert on you, and you're the expert on what you love to do. And make sure that you ask questions and get information that serves what you want to get out of the lesson or out of your skiing or snowboarding. Sometimes people come to the lesson and think they're like, they have a passive role in the lesson. Like, yes, they have to work hard and try to learn, but the instructor dictates everything. And as an instructor and coach, the more input a student gives me, the more successful I'm going to be. If you share with me that you liked that, you didn't like that, that was hard, that was easy, that felt fast to you, that felt slow to you, that's exactly what you wanted to do, no, you'd like to tweak it. Like, the more input a student can give an instructor so that it's genuinely a partnership, that's going to be the kick-ass experience.
That's great advice, to make it a partnership with your instructor. Robin Barnes, it's been an absolute pleasure and a total delight to spend this hour with you. I'm sure my dear listeners will get a ton of good information out of it. And I wish you and Mr. Rogan the very best of ski seasons there in the years ahead.
Maxim, thank you for your graciousness. On behalf of Michael, he says happy holidays to you and thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure. And I hope you're right. I hope your listeners do glean some information.
I'm sure they will. This has been Jackson Hogan for Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Thanks for listening.